So spring break's coming. Spring break is coming.
Did you have a Dunbar here?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great. Did you have Karen? What's her name? Top physics.
Probably not. I didn't know she was courses.
Okay. She does the science fair stuff too. We have a science fair this weekend. If you all want to help out.
I'm working.
Okay. All right, so we might as well get going, I guess. Just to remind you, right, where we are, we're going to try to finish up muscle. That's right here. And then and it says catch-up lectures because I knew I would get behind. So this is part of the catch-up. And then we'll probably try to finish muscle today, maybe get into sensory. Sensory, there's kind of an overlap from things that we've already talked about in the past, so we'll cruise through some of that. And then next week, what are we doing next week? Next week we have maybe this quiz coming up, right? And then that Thursday next week is when we want to finish off that assignment of that newspaper article. And we've got some up already that people have sent in. It looks really good. Nice topics. They're really quite interesting. I wish everybody could read everybody else's topics. It's interesting what people are coming up with. Some really interesting ones. And then later in the course, we'll tell you what day we're going to pull names. Maybe the same day we have a quiz. So it's like, if you want to come to class, where's that go? Then we'll do it at the same time. We'll take the quiz and then pull some names out of the hat, a couple of them, and then you can present on what you've read and share with the rest of the class. It's kind of get other people to share what they've read about. Sound good? Yes. Okay. All right. To get you all hyped up for the day, there's this really cool video. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but we'll just play it. It's really kind of fun. Have you all seen this before? It's really cool. I like it. Get you going. Since we're talking about muscle. So when I don't think we did that in, did we? We didn't do that in the outreach center. Should have done that. Where we record EMGs. Have you ever seen that little thing where we record with EMGs? Backyard Brains is really cool. They sell this little kit. Have you ever seen Backyard Brains? No? You should check it out. It's really neat. They sell these little kits. It's great for outreaching, and you can put EMG electrodes on, say, somebody, and then have that connected onto the next person, and you contract your arm, and it stimulates their nerve, and their arm contracts, right? So we kind of do that as demonstrations about your electricity thing can stimulate their nerve, and they contract, right? And they lost control of their arm. It's kind of neat when you think about what they can do. So where's kind of the point with that, too? I know it's kind of gee-whizzy, but how about the next deeper level? What do you think about that? Any ideas come to mind? Have you seen that on, there was a CNN article that was out a couple months ago where the guy was in the wheelchair and he was controlling the wheelchair with muscles that he could use in his pectoral muscles and he could move things around, or even now using prosthetics, right, that you want to have your arm, it's an artificial arm, but how do you control that? They can't have that hooked up. There's so many neat things out there that people are doing where they put even a strip on the motor cortex. And so when you think you want to move your arm out, that will fire that region and like where your hand is, motor cortex, will move your hands out, but it's not as fine a control. They're finding that it's easier to actually have electrodes hooked up on muscles that you can control, like your back muscle or maybe your pectoral muscle or other muscles that you can actually train to then work that prosthetic limb. So that's really amazing what's coming out there. So it's kind of, you know, this is gee whizzy that we just saw, but think of the implications of where it can go. And that's what people are doing today. And it's really quite amazing. So there's a lot of neat things. How do you get electricity when you record, like on an EMG, and you put those two electrodes, and then you measure an activity when you contract? What are we measuring? I mean, it's electrical signals, but what do those electrical signals do to? Back to the neuro stuff, same thing, right? I know you know it, you're just shy.
Action potentials.
Action potentials, yes, in a sense, but the physical thing, as I'm thinking of, the movement of ions, right? The movement of ions. And those ions that move then generate electric field, and we can pick those up. So EMG, electromyogram, versus like an EEG, electroencephalogram, right? Or an EKG across your heart. So even monitoring your heart, right? When we get into the cardiovascular, the EKG trace, that's the electrical signals of your heart. So it's pretty cool. All right, so that just gets you the idea what's happening. Oh, something's rolling. All right, that's mine. No, it's yours. Okay.
Wow, that's cool. Whoa,
thank you.
Thank you.
All that's pretty cool. All right, so where we left off last time was to talk about bands and the sarcomere. So I did mention that you really, if you're studying this, what you need to do is to take a blank piece of paper, draw out three sarcomeres. All right, draw out three sarcomeres and do band and write out the banding pattern. I know this is really something you just have to memorize and put down to memory, because you're going to see something like that again, maybe in a multiple choice or an open response. But if you have that down, you've got it nailed. All right, so we'll go through some of that over and over again a bit. But and then which bands move during contraction? Really neat to see these bands. You can see them on a single cell. What people do, and there's a good, as I mentioned, a good group here at UK, Center of Muscle Biology. People over in the physiology department study single muscle fibers as well. It's really neat the way they study them in so many ways. Think about if you want to understand muscle contraction, but how are you going to get that muscle to contract like you did in your lab, right? Did you stimulate the nerve or do you stimulate the muscle directly this year? Some of the years we switch it around. Were you stimulating a nerve or a muscle directly? The nerve, okay. So when you're thinking about doing that, think what could happen. You're stimulating the nerve repeatedly and measuring muscle force of contraction. But if that starts to dampen, was it due to the nerve? Was it due to the synaptic transmission? Or is it the muscle itself? So people want to remove the nervous system and stimulate the muscle directly. So when you stimulate the muscle directly, then you depolarize that muscle, make action potentials, and it contracts. But if you wanted to understand, is it a problem maybe in the channels on the membrane if it's not working right, right? Or is it something in the contractile elements? So then you want to get rid of the membrane and you want to study the contractile elements. So people do this at all different levels. So what people, if you're reading a paper and you read something called permeolized muscle fibers, they will actually permeolize the plasma membrane, poke holes in it like with a soap, and now you have the contractile elements that you can still attach that single muscle fiber to like this. And then what they do is they put it in different baths or change the bath really quickly, like with calcium or no calcium or with ATP, ATP in calcium. So at all different ways to try to understand how muscle functions and then looking at diseased muscle, for example. So Ken Campbell over in the physiology department, he's really big into single muscle fiber recordings. And he uses permeolized membranes to understand defects and how the myosin actin interact and have muscle contraction. And they look at diseased hearts. So his students, in that sense, that are working in the lab, they're like on call 24/7. So when they have somebody that's having a heart transplant, for example, they will actually take out a piece of that diseased heart if there was something wrong with how the heart was functioning, a disorder, and then study the individual muscle fibers in the lab. And now they found a way that they can actually take these samples out and they don't have to immediately go study them physiologically. They can preserve them and then study it when they have, when they're back awake again. But they're right there in the room. Somebody's getting heart transplant. They take the old heart tissue, give that to the students, and then they take it and preserve it now so it can be utilized. And then they find out what's wrong with the contractile elements, for example, or maybe calcium handling. And so that's really quite neat. And you think at the level that people are doing this kind of research, it's really exciting, I think, somewhat, right? Because then if you can also understand there might be some other issues or genetic issues with heart development. But anyway, it's pretty neat. Some of the ways to look at muscle contraction, to study it, it's somewhat like this with those little red lines. You see these marks for sarcomeres, and they'll actually project an image up on the wall, and the wall is calibrated so you can see a bigger image, so you can see the finer changes that go on. I think that's pretty neat as well. So lots of different ideas people have that they look at to understand muscle function. But let's go through some of the general points of it. Some of you might already know a lot about muscle, but just to make sure that we're all on the same page, we do want to, as I mentioned, understand the sarcomere. So really drawing a couple of sarcomeres so you can understand how these bands overlap through the Z-disc. So the A-band is made up of what? Myosin, right? And it shouldn't change with muscle contraction because that's the middle part. Remember the pen that we went over? But then, as the actin from the Z-disc, as the actin slides over the myosin, then that's going to slide over the A-band, so you start to see some changes in the light bands in between. Right? And so this I-band's going to change because this goes across the sarcomere, and as the myosin gets closer to the Z-disc, right? So, look over that. You might see in some textbooks, depending which one you have, they might have listed this as half of the I-band, because it's only half of it, right? Just to make sure you're not confused. Sometimes that was confusing in past classes. And we did mention that the way that they really worked this out was by cross-sections. And they did a lot of cross-sections through muscle that was stretched out or contracted. And then they came up with this idea that actin must be moving over the myosin, called, what is it called?
Sliding
filament hypothesis, exactly. And then now they have lots of markers in understanding how this muscle general contraction works. Not only that, over in physiology, and Ken Campbell's part of it, he's actually developed computational programs to actually see the myosin heads, how they bind. And there's a lot of computational work in a comparative aspect with different animals about this whole 3D arrangement in the sense of... So here's the myosin, and if you look at one myosin here, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 actin around there. So you have 6 actin. And you can really get very involved into it, but we won't get to there. And the point of the myosin heads, how they rotate around the myosin molecule so they can interact with all the different actins in a three-dimensional arrangement. So there's computer programs. If somebody goes to Ken Campbell's website, for example, I think it's still up there. There's a computer program where he's built it with MATLAB, and it shows all the myosin heads and how they work. And so think about it. Would we want all the myosin heads, when we're talking about contraction, would we want all the myosin heads on both sides, right, to attach to the actin and contract? Do we want all the myosin heads to come off for as they have to ratchet, right? They're ratcheting, right? They bind, they ratchet forward, they come off, they relax, they bind again, they ratchet forward, right? You get the idea? Would we want them all to come off? Like, think of a Viking ship you see in the movies, right? Everybody's rowing, right, at once, right? Do you want all the oars to be raised at one time to then bind again and then paddle? Or what would you think was the problem with that, for example? That was an old open response question before.
Yeah, what goes is going to just go back to normal.
That's right. If there was force on that, right, if all the oars came off, and it wasn't moving forward like a ship would in the water, right? And so it's a little bit different. Then that all that would stretch back out and you're back to where you started if you're trying to build up force, right? So you don't want all the heads to come off at once. You want some to come off, the next ones to bind, and they rotate around. That's the idea of the three-dimensional conformation here. And so people have studied even how much force one myosin head would generate on an actin when it moves forward. So how much force does it take to move that myosin head to bend it down and contract? So people study that. They use it, what's called laser tweezers, for example, and they can even get the force generated by a single myosin head. And then you relate it to how many myosin heads bind to the actin and cause muscle force contraction. And so it's kind of interesting mathematical computations that are used. When you look at different animals, we won't go through all the different animals, but there's actually different types where you might get 6 or 9 actin around a myosin, and quite interesting because then that means that something's different the way they're all arranged, right? And for muscle contraction. So what if you saw, you know, if you now know that the Z disc, or where the actin binds here, attaches, right? And this actin out there is attaching to the myosin, so on both sides, right? And they're going to ratchet and cause that to contract. What if you went to, you know, some jungle somewhere and you found this interesting animal and you wanted to understand about it and you took a muscle biopsy and you saw the Z discs were really thick and they had a really prominent Z pattern to it. And then you looked at maybe another muscle in the animal and you noticed real thin Z lines and not a very Z-like pattern. Why does the Z-like pattern come up? Some people just might be not for sure about it. The Z-like pattern here is because the actin's binding here and pulling on this one, and it's pulling on this one. So if you blew this up, it would look like a Z. That's why they call it a Z. So what do you think? I forgot my hat today. Can't just randomly draw on people. Z disc, actin attached to the sides. You've probably got an answer. No? Yes? No? Not sure. You have an answer.
Why it looks like?
Yeah, yeah. And why would it be thicker in one muscle fiber and maybe thinner in another one and more prominent? Now knowing the anatomy. Does structure, function go together? Give her a help. Lifeline. Give her a lifeline.
The thicker one probably is the muscle that generates more force.
Exactly. So they've looked at these and they've actually seen where the Z disc is really thick and a more prominent Z pattern. Those are the muscles that are force generating, strong force generating, and usually ones that might have constant force. You know, something that would be maybe lifting or force power, not just a real fast movement. So that holds pretty true looking on a comparative aspect as well. So you get the idea, structure function relationship with that. All right, and this cross sections is pretty neat because this is how they worked out the sliding filament hypothesis. So just to kind of go through some of these structures in here, and I know it's a bit to remember, but we'll tie it all back together here when we talk about the whole muscle contraction, just to show you some blown up views of it. So if we look at the actin, remember the actin is bound to the Z disc. If you look on the actin, there's this structure that's really quite interesting called tropomyosin. In some animals, you might see some text, if you're reading primary literature, is it might be called paramyosin. It's the same, basically the same idea. But what's interesting is this actin is wrapped around, these two actin bands are wrapped around. So the idea to take away from this is, what if you had some big rope, two strands of big rope, right? You got one strand and the other strand, and then you wind them together, right? Now you have this kind of wound two big strands of rope. Right, you wound it around each other. And then you take some yarn, and you take two strands of yarn, and you wrap that around, and now you put that in the groove of the big rope. All right, this is the way this looks. And so that tropomyosin is like those two strands of yarn inside the grooves of the big rope. But in the tropomyosin, you attach another piece of yarn, right? So this third piece, that's not the whole length. But on that third little piece, you have a myosin head on, right? So this is how this is all held together. So just if you visualize this, I think then you have it set in your mind. And that troponin complex is where we have the site where calcium binds and then exposes what's called an active site on the actin. That active site on the actin is where the myosin head binds. So the take-home here is that calcium will bind to this troponin complex, and there's three different parts of this troponin complex will go through, and then it moves the head, again, conformational change, like we've talked about many times, conformational change, the protein changes its structure, exposes an active site on the actin, and then just think those myosin heads are just waiting to attach to that active site. So as soon as that active site's exposed, the myosin head's going to bind to it. And then it's going to ratchet. As soon as it binds to it, it's going to ratchet forward. So you have to get that active site exposed. What caused that active site exposed? Calcium binding to troponin. Okay. So this is that structure on the actin. If we now look at the myosin heads are again really quite interesting. And this is where ATP is cleaved. But on these tails, you don't have to memorize the lengths and anything like that. That all varies depending on critters and stuff. But the idea here is, again, this kind of coiled structure and two myosin heads. So when you think of that myosin, it's not just one head, it's two heads. And they're a little bit off from each other. So one might bind here, and then the next one binds. Bind, bind. You know, and they have two different active sites that they could bind to. So it's really quite interesting when you put it all together in a three-dimensional site. The thing is, these are called myosin light chains, or you can call them, you know, this is where the head region is of the myosin. Okay. So some pretty interesting aspects, like we mentioned, you could permeabilize muscle, like with glycerol, and then take away the glycerol, and these myosins will reform again. That's pretty amazing. The idea is that dudes call these different structures. We don't have to go into it, but it's a way to break it down and to understand how this myosin works. And so people break down myosin from different animals, for example, run them on a gel, and then you can see different myosin banding patterns depending on the muscle fiber type. So different muscle fiber types have different structures in here, and that's kind of interesting too. So as I mentioned, you can disassociate those and they come right back together. So this guy, Albert St. Georgi, you ever hear of this guy before? Probably not. But there's two people that won the Nobel Prize for vitamin C. Who are the two people? Who's the one that you might remember? Anybody remember vitamin C? Important. You know, you eat it and you think you're going to get a cold, but they found out it doesn't really relate that much. Any ideas? Vitamin C. Who else won the Nobel Prize for vitamin C? Yes. Yes, there you go. And this guy, too. So there were actually two Nobel Prizes with vitamin C. Isn't that amazing? But this guy did a tremendous amount of work. This guy has really done so much. So there's a whole, you know, Wikipedia page on him and everything. Really quite interesting for his work. But he also worked a lot with the citric acid cycle. You might not remember. You know, remember all that from chapter whatever that was, 3? Right, he worked out a lot of the reactions in the citric acid cycle, helped to understand the biochemistry, but he also worked out a lot about muscle mechanics and how muscle works. And so he's kind of under-recognized for his work. And he did some of his work where? MBL, that marine biology laboratory I told you about in Woods Hole. That's really quite interesting. All right, so Albert St. Georgi was the one that worked out a lot of the early on about muscle, breaking it down and looking at the different components, and then had some really pretty neat ideas about how muscle works. So the idea is, this is a good figure to try to remember for exams, is which bands are shortening, and this I band is shortening quite a bit, right? Because it goes between the two myosin groups across the Z-disc. And this other band, the H zone, is between the two individual actins, so that's shortening as well, right? So you think of it shortening together. Now, let's think about the myosin heads. So if you look at the top, you have so many myosin heads binding up here, right? And there could be some more to still bind. But there's this little problem about this structure. If we go back to this, let's look here. When you look at the myosin in the middle, there's no myosin heads, right? So even though the actin might shorten a little bit more over this region, there's no more myosin heads that are bound to that. So it's kind of an interesting structure, and that's going to come up to be a point here in a minute. So just think about this. But let's say that not all the myosin heads are bound yet. We're not over that middle region. So as this shortens a little bit more, you could end up with more myosin heads binding to it, right? So that means more force. Think of a tug of war, right? You have a tug of war, and you know half the room has got the big rope, and half the room over here, but we only had 3 people on it. And then we recruit your others, right? And you get more people on it. And you can generate more force if you can measure in the middle. So it's the same idea of adding more people to the tug of war on the rope. So more force generated. But if you're not adding any more to it, it might actually, you might pull up to each other, right, on both sides, but there's no increased force in the middle because you haven't added any more heads to it. But what happens when you get into this region? These myosin heads are now interfering with the other myosin heads on the other side, right? Or the actin binding sites, I should say. But they're interfering, so you're actually decreasing the force that that can generate, right? Because you're not going to have as many myosin heads bound to it. This is important when we start to look at these relative tension and sarcomere lengths. So this is for a single sarcomere. The idea is that this is a little confusing sometimes, and the textbooks haven't really caught up with what the current literature is on with this. But when they worked out this, this is for a single sarcomere, and this is the model that Huxley came up with a long time ago. So people question some of this model, but the general idea of how the muscle works to develop tension on a single sarcomere. So we already mentioned if you stretch it way out, there's no heads involved, so there's no tension really. As those heads start to overlap with the actin, you're getting force developed. But even though you shorten a little bit, because of that middle region that doesn't have any myosin heads, there's no change in the force. But when they start to overlap and interfere with each other, now you're decreasing your force, right? Does that make sense? Hopefully, here, somewhat. Okay. Physiologically, most animals are just working in this range in here, like in this top region. They're not working at this very extreme region because you probably have damaged muscle, and you're not working in this region for most mammals, right? So in mammalian muscles this way. There are some really interesting animals, particularly the barnacle type of muscle that you see like on a pier in the ocean when you're out in spring break somewhere in Florida. Look at those muscles that are on the pier. They have some really interesting muscles that people have worked with. Some types of these muscles actually can contract. They're super contracting muscles. It's phenomenal. They're really quite interesting. And people still trying to use those as understanding some of the models. But they can contract so much to shorten their muscles so much that these actin can actually go through the myosin. I mean, the Z-disc. The actin will shorten so much, there's holes in the Z-disc where they can shorten so much that they actually go through the Z-disc. So you can actually see the actin passing through. So the Z-disc isn't solid protein all the way through it. That's kind of odd, right? But they're called supercontracting muscles. So only a few critters have them that people have found. So some animals can work in a very short sarcomere length, but then they can extend quite a long length. What's interesting is if you look at the sarcomere length in different muscle fiber types. And when we talk about this muscle fiber types, what are we generally thinking about? Anybody? When you go to KFC, Kentucky KFC, right? And they ask you, do you want white meat or dark meat? Right? What are they asking about? Red or white, basically. And why do we have red and white? It relates to fast and slow muscle. So you can think of those analogies. It's gross. I know it's kind of gross in the sense of gross analogy. In the sense of red and white, dark meat, white meat, tonic and phasic muscle, are fast and slow muscle, okay? Those are all kind of used interchangeably, but what do we mean here is we mean slow muscle is the red muscle, white muscle is more of the fast muscle. Now, why do they have different colors? And we're thinking about mammals, right? And if you actually dissected a mammal, you found a mouse, you killed it in your basement, I know this sounds gross maybe, and you dissected it open, you could look at the muscles, and with white light, you would see differences in the color of the muscle. All right, just to make the point. Why is there color differences? Anybody have ideas? Ideas? Let's see if anybody's awake back there. Is anybody awake back there? Yes. With a cap? No, you don't want to say anything? Yes, go for it. Yes, pigments that carry oxygen, really good. So the red muscle, which is a slow muscle, which is going to be fatigue resistant, has more capillary beds to it for one thing. And so in mammals, what's carrying that oxygen? Hemoglobin. If you isolate hemoglobin and put white light to it, it looks red, right? because you know that if you cut your skin, right? You bleed. Not only that, in red muscle, there's another oxygen binding pigment called myoglobin. It's like hemoglobin, it can bind oxygen. But it's one globular unit. It's not the four globular units. Okay, so it's one globular unit. So it's not a quaternary structure, right? It's a tertiary structure. Test question. You know, so it's a tertiary structure, myoglobin. Myoglobin can bind oxygen stronger than hemoglobin. Why would you want that? You want to get that oxygen into the muscle fiber, right? Off the hemoglobin. So you want a sink for it. So myoglobin can bind oxygen stronger than hemoglobin, has a greater affinity, pulls that oxygen out of the blood capillaries and into the muscle fiber. If you isolate myoglobin, put it in a test tube and hold it up to white light, it looks red. So that's kind of cool. So you got another reason that's reddish. How about the other situation? If you have slow muscle that's working all the time, like your postural muscles, right, are walking, versus muscles that you don't use that often. If you're going to jump up and shoot baskets or something, you're using more or less your fast muscle. But that slow muscle that hopefully keeps our neck awake so we don't fall over and fall asleep, that muscle is working all the time. So what does it need? ATP, right? So where do you get the ATP? Mitochondria. So if you looked in that muscle, you'll find more mitochondria in the slow muscle than you will in the fast muscle. If you isolate mitochondria into a test tube and you hold up to white light, it looks red. So there's lots of reasons that red muscle looks red, or dark muscle looks more darker than white muscle or fast muscle. Mitochondria, the electron transport chain in there, those cytochromes, give it a reddish color in white light. So more mitochondria, more myoglobin, more circulation in the mammalian system, so it looks more red or dark muscle. Okay, so the general classification. Now, that's real simplistic. Now you can take those classification and you can break it up even more into the biochemical differences of slow muscle and fast muscle. And we'll look a little bit of that. But the general idea is that slow muscle, actually, when you look at it on a comparative aspect, like in crustaceans, your favorite animals, and insects, the muscle that's slow muscle, that generates a lot of force, it actually has longer sarcomeres. So generally, long sarcomeres for slow muscle, for fast muscle, shorter sarcomeres. So it's really quite interesting when you look at the function-structure relationship, again, but with muscle fibers and the structures related in them. Okay. So lots of ways that people have studied muscle this year. You did not stimulate the nerve. You stimulated the nerve and not the muscle directly. Some years, we actually have the electrodes on that setup that you can actually stimulate the muscle directly, and you don't have to stimulate the nerve, and you can look at muscle contraction that way, independent of the nerve. Remember we talked about fatigue? Remember what fatigue is, right? So, like you're running the race, and you can't run anymore, and you're just tired, but if someone comes behind you and says, chop, chop, and you get going, and then all of a sudden you can run a little bit more, so it's not like you don't have the energy in the muscle fiber. It's just that motivation is a big factor with fatigue, right? Activating that nervous system. So you want to get away from that. Well, take that muscle nerve out and repetitively stimulate it. And then you don't have that mental aspect to it. But then that can start to fail. So is it the nerve or is it the muscle itself that ran out of energy? So if you want to ask that question, then you can stimulate the muscle directly and take away the nerve and see if the muscle can still contract. We've done that with crustacean muscles. I think I mentioned that before, is that a muscle fiber in a crustacean can have two types of motor neurons innervating the same muscle fiber, a high output phasic type and a low output tonic type. And you can repetitively stimulate the phasic one, and then you'll watch the excitatory synaptic potentials start to drop and the muscle tension starts to drop. So we were wondering, is it that nerve or is it the muscle? Can the muscle still contract? You can turn around and stimulate the tonic one to the same muscle fiber at a higher frequency, and it can contract. So it seems to be more of the nerve terminal in that situation of the lack of being able to continue up and release fuse vesicles and release transmitter to cause the muscle contraction. So kind of interesting points. All right, so if we looked at this tension muscle, if you stretch your muscle out, you can stretch it, and then there's going to be some tension there that can develop, even though you're not controlling it by your nerves activating it, right? Because if you stretch it, if you took it out, you could stretch it, you're going to get some tension. And so this is the tension from passive stretch, not stimulating the nerve, not actively doing that. So there's some resistance to that stretching the muscle fiber. Think of myosin heads, some of them there, you got connective tissue, all that that you're stretching, the membrane as well. So this is the tension from passive stretch. All right, and then this is overstretching. This is why it says 2 times the normal. This is not where you want to be. This would be like if you cut that tendon, stretch it out longer than it should be, right? But it's the force that generates from the other structures that are in there, like the collagen and other aspects. And then if you stimulated the muscle, then you can see that tension curve go way up. But it's going to start riding on the passive tension of just stretching out that muscle. Okay. So we kind of went through that. A little bit that's really quite interesting, and I should maybe pop that on the find the Wikipedia page. There's a really good Wikipedia page on Titan. So in your textbooks, and a lot of textbooks haven't caught up with this. There's even a med physiology textbook that hasn't caught up with this. They miss this protein called Titan. It's the largest protein in your body. Is that not amazing? The largest protein in your body. And they missed it for so many years to describe this protein. Even homogenizing the muscle and putting it on a gel and getting all the banding patterns, right, to try to understand. Because it was so big, it wasn't migrating through the gel. It stayed at the top of the gel. Remember, the smaller molecules will go through the gel. And so they could look at all the banding, cut it out, find out what the protein is. But this would always stay at the top. And then people were wondering, what is that stuff up at the top? You know, finally beginning to question this stuff. And then they found out, wow, this is Titan. This is this molecule that's gigantic, and it happens to be in muscle. It's the largest protein in you. And it's really quite amazing. And remember, muscle mass is your largest mass in your body. But it's interesting when they found out about it, and there's still debates about how it's working. And now they found Titan-like molecules in every skeletal muscle that they've looked at, even in insects and crustaceans, but different types of isoforms. And what it does, it's really quite amazing. It binds to the Z-disc, and how this is working, there's different models. But the idea is it's binding to the Z-disc, and it binds up to the myosin ends. Sometimes in some of the diagrams, you will see this Titan that comes across here and actually goes along the whole length of the myosin. So it's going along this whole length of the myosin on both sides. So why is it there? Now the idea has come about, what is it doing? Well, it keeps it in line, for one thing, but it keeps it from ripping apart. And it's thought to be, this is what keeps your muscles from tearing, right? That it's so strong on the Z-disc, but then integrated in that myosin, that when you pull on it, this is what keeps it all intact. So now they found disorders with Titan, genetic disorders, and actually seeing that muscle doesn't work as well. And so it's really quite interesting, or you can express disorders with it and then find out that there's some interesting problems. So you get the idea here. Here's this sequence of this, and people have gone molecular on this and actually look at the genes that are expressing this and trying to understand more about disease states with it. But there's something else that's interesting, is it's thought to be a molecule that's kind of, and if the muscle's contracting from Z-disc to Z-disc, and this actin's overlapping to the myosin, what's happening to the Titan in the middle? It should just kind of like wad up in there, right? And how's it going to still get smaller, right, and contract? Well, now they looked at the structure of the protein, and it's like little coils that's wrapped around. So this now they think that the Titan actually has loops in it and can coil like a spring, and it can coil up and then be very compact. And when you stretch it, the spring undoes. And so that's pretty neat. And that's now thought that's part of the passive tension in those tension curves. So it's kind of interesting. Now, you know, science progresses the more you understand it, and it can still build on the ideas that people had in the past as more information is discovered. So it's really neat. The Titan is a large molecule, and now it's related with different types of disease states in humans and other animals. And so it's quite interesting. If we look at the structure of your plasma membrane of muscle, I just want to bring this up. You don't have to memorize these. It's not to, you know, give you a heart attack. But the idea is, in that plasma membrane of a muscle, look at all the proteins. I mean, we just kind of went through actin and myosin, troponin and tropomyosin, and, you know, calcium binding and causing that. But there's so much more to muscle. If you think about all the collagen that's out from the muscle membrane to the basal membrane around it, there's a lot of interaction of proteins. And then you start to go inside of this of the cell, and then you see that there's proteins bound in the membrane, and then there's proteins going inside of the muscle cell. And here's one of them, dystrophin. What does that kind of ring a bell with you? Muscular dystrophy. So they know that muscular dystrophy, and there's different forms of muscular dystrophy, it has to do with this dystrophin molecule not being right. So if this dystrophin molecule, and there's different forms of muscular dystrophy, and they know exactly where these different structural problems are in the dystrophin, are in the complex that it binds to, is that that causes weak muscles. And so muscular dystrophy, they have weak muscles. And so they're kind of floppy in that sense too. And it's a very debilitating disease. So people are actually trying to do gene therapy to create the correct proteins, right, with muscular dystrophy. And they have animal models that they've worked on with this as well. Maybe someday they'll actually be able to correct the defective proteins with gene therapy. But it also might be a problem with legal issues and gene therapy in different places. That's something else we could get into. But this dystrophin complex is really quite amazing. So this is that plasma membrane again, and the dystrophin that we talked about here, and people know there's different disorders with this or with that, and can really break down these diseases now. But now that you've classified it, now, you know, where do you go? And the therapy is the next aspect to try to correct these disorders. So we'll see what happens in time. So when you hear basal lamina, that's outside the muscle membrane. That's this matrix that's outside. And the basal lamina is holding these different muscle groups together as well. So this is important to think about all this aspect. All right, and then this is inside of the cell. So there's lots of information that's going on inside of the cell to keep that structure integrity. So there's groups, researchers here at UK, for example, that just study this protein or just this complex, are the basal lamina itself, and then how muscle grows and how does it atrophy, and all these other aspects with these proteins and turnover rate of all these proteins, which is really quite interesting. Muscle, as I mentioned, degrades very fast, right? You cut the nerve to your skeletal muscle, your muscle will degrade in 20 minutes. Your muscle is going to start degrading, right? You have a heart attack, for example, right? And what do they measure in your blood? They measure the myosin. They used to have, wasn't that long ago, right? If you had stress and you thought you had a heart attack, you end up in the ER, they take a blood sample and they could look at that blood sample and say, oh, you had a heart attack, I think, because what they would stain for or measure was the myosin. The myosin heavy chains. But the problem was, they didn't know if that came from skeletal muscle or cardiac myosin. So maybe you went out and you patched your roof on the house on the weekend, or you did some really physical exercise, and your muscles are damaged, right? If you exercise and you're sore, that actually tore up some muscles. And you could measure the muscle degradation products in your blood, but they couldn't tell if that was from the heart or from skeletal muscle. Now they have cardiac-specific myosin detectors, so they can actually pull that blood out and say, oh, that's cardiac myosin, and now we know that you probably had a heart attack within the last 4 hours. They can actually narrow it down when you probably had the defect in your heart, like some clot, right, that didn't happen. And then that tissue dies, and when that tissue dies, what happens? The cells lyse, then that all spills out into your blood, and that's what you can detect. And so now they use that as a detection process to kind of see when the problems went up. Your myosin heavy chains, cardiac myosin heavy chains are really high. The cells have, you know, died at a certain time. And if they're still increasing, that means there's still more problems happening, right? Or if it's already dropped, then you know that's pretty much over with. But this is just an idea here to look at these muscles. And one of your favorite animals, which is crayfish. If you remember those crayfish when they raise their claws up and they try to pinch you in the lab, right? If you pinch on those claws, they autotomize. There's a little plane where they autotomize it off, and they'll regrow a new claw. But what happens to that muscle that lifted that claw, that big heavy claw. It's called levator muscle, right? And if you pinch on a big animal, big crayfish, and you pinch it and he lost that claw, there's no more weight to lift up, right? Even though it's in the water and it's not as heavy. Wait 3 months where it starts to regenerate a little tiny little claw, and you can look at that levator muscle. So that's a levator muscle on the right-hand side of an animal that was just regenerating claw after 3 months versus on the contralateral side of the same animal that had the claw. Look at the size of the muscle here. So this muscle is quite large, and look what it atrophied to, these little tiny muscle bundles. So you get the idea that can atrophy quite quickly. But what's interesting is this animal is going to regenerate its claw back, right? And that muscle is going to rebuild. And so it's very dynamic for, you know, atrophying and then rebuilding. That's amazing. And remember the behavioral aspect we talked about, the fiddler crab that has a big claw and the small claw? And then think about that muscle. So people are looking at that because that changes. You pinch that one off and now this becomes a big claw and that muscle now has to deal with it. And fiddler crabs aren't always in the water. They're walking on the sand. So that's actually a pretty heavy claw to pick up. So that even has more dramatic change in the muscle fiber. Now, what about the innervation? The nerve has to innervate that muscle and release the right amount of transmitter to contract that muscle. So that has to go along with the muscle fiber. So that's kind of interesting also. How does that work? How does it keep it up? That's pretty neat. And so this is where people are still trying to understand ideas. Okay, so if we talk about two different types of muscle force of contraction, we generally talk about it as isometric or isotonic. What do we mean by that? Iso is the same, right? And metric is length. Right? So isometric, the muscle doesn't change length. And then isotonic, it changes length, but it doesn't change the amount of weight that it has to lift. So the easiest way to think about this is thinking about picking up barbells off the ground, and you're trying to lift it up, but it's not off the ground yet. So it really hasn't been able to pull that up, but it's the same length, right? Your tendon hasn't changed in the length. You can't pick it up, but you're generating some force. So that's isometric. But as soon as you can pick the bell bar up and start to contract it, you're in isotonic, right? The weights haven't changed, but your muscles shorten. So that's the general idea. Now, this has been questioned and is changing. If you take a really good course, if you're around next year and you don't want to take human physiology, PGY 412G, which is human physiology, you'll do well in that course after this course. But then, if you want to really push it, there's a course called PGY 502. PGY 412 is a four-hour course. There's no lab. Okay, the labs are kind of fun sometimes. And then there's the 502, which is a five-hour course. You can take it. We've had undergraduates take that course. It is a leveling course that a lot of the departments in the med school, and we use it here in biology too, for students to take as a leveling course to really understand physiology and to go through all the systems. It's very fast-paced. It's maybe even more so than the med physiology course. Same instructors. So five-hour course, 5 days a week pretty much. But really interesting. Now, if you take those courses that are pushing a little bit more in the primary literature, for example, the 502, and we should bring it up here so you've heard about it, you're not caught off guard, is that people really don't think we have isometric contraction. Now, why do you think that? So some people, when you hear, there's no such thing as isometric contraction. What do you mean by that? The idea is that when you're trying to pick up that barbell, but you're not getting it off the ground, right? You generated force, right? You feel, you know, you feel the force, right? Your biceps get bigger, right, as you're trying to pull it up. So how did that happen? How do you generate force? But the whole muscle length hasn't changed. But if you look at the individual sarcomeres, right, you had to have more myosin heads overlapping to generate that force, to be able to overcome it finally. So the idea is that we don't have truly an isometric contraction. We talk about the individual sarcomeres. They have to shorten, right, to generate the force. So I just want you to think about that, that you're not caught off guard ever hearing somebody says there's no such thing as isometric when you talk about the individual muscle fiber contracting, because you have to generate that force, and that's happening from the actin sliding over the myosin, developing that force. Okay? So to just kind of think that in your mind a little bit, and so you're not caught off guard. But generally, you will hear about isometric and isotonic. Okay, so what's happening up in the space station? What happens with the cosmonauts and the astronauts? And the Russians really were good with this research because they had cosmonauts up in space for a long time, right? And when they came down, they couldn't walk. So what was the problem, do you think? Yes.
Working the muscles.
That's right. They weren't working the muscles. Zero gravity, or pretty much zero gravity. There's a little bit of gravity in the space station, not a lot. But the aspect is they weren't able to exercise their muscles. So their muscles atrophied so much. And they could take biopsies, and they did a lot of these biopsies. And they found out the muscles are atrophying too much. So they came up with a whole exercise regime that then NASA took on as well. I mean, you think about what the Russians have done in muscle physiology, they've actually exceeded quite a lot. They used to actually sample school kids in schools. Probably can't do that here. They used to sample school kids and do muscle biopsies of them and find out which kid basically had a super amount of fast muscle fibers, because genetically it would be linked to you, right? Or which ones had, you know, a high level of slow muscle fibers. And then start using those kids and start training them for the Olympics. Because if you had that genetic predisposition for really fast muscles, you're going to be a great sprinter. And if you had a lot of the slow muscles, then you could probably be a really good long-distance runner. So they actually did this. And so it's kind of interesting. And we do that in other places. But you're not going to take a sprinter and train them to be a long-distance runner. It's just not going to work, right? One's with fast muscle. And you're not going to take somebody with really slow muscle and get them to be the world athlete in fast sprinting. So this is what went on for a good while, and then they stopped a lot of that stuff. But with the astronauts or cosmonauts, they did a lot of these studies. So what do you think the regime is now to exercise in space to keep them from... And if you go to the International Space Station, go to NASA and look at the International Space Station. It's fantastic. They got so many cool videos up there and really neat stuff. What do you think they might do to keep their muscles from atrophying? Are they going to lift weights? So what do you think they do? Anybody interested in physical therapy? It's kind of
rubber bands.
Rubber bands, exactly. They use rubber bands as force. And they even use their own arms. So if they pushed against their own arms like that, they could exercise or push against the wall, for example, in the space station, right? So they could put their back on one side and put their feet on the other and push against this. But they use rubber bands. They even have a bicycle that they stand up. There's like no seat. And they are pedaling on a bicycle with resistance. Keep their muscles up. So they have to exercise so many hours a day to keep their muscles from atrophying. And so that breaks up their day to do anything on the space station for other kinds of experiments to keep them healthy. Think about their cardiovascular issues too. There's no gravity, right? So we have to pump blood up to get it to our brain and then force it around in our capillary beds. And gravity helps that whole process as well, right? And then we have to fight gravity. So their hearts change as well. And so they're trying to do things that would keep that actually healthy for them as well. So that's why when they come back down in the older days, they used to have to rehab them for quite some time. And nowadays, they don't have to rehab as quickly, but they're still careful with heart attacks and lots of things. And if you're so it's really quite interesting. The whole topic is really neat. There's some great books. I'll bring some by to show you the titles. But Extreme Medicine, this physiologist actually wrote, he's a physician, actually wrote about the physiology in extreme conditions, like space, or high altitude, or cold, and what happens physiologically to the body. And it was really quite interesting. And now he actually is a consultant for NASA, but he just got interested in this when he was in med school, and he realized, hey, this is really quite neat. And so he got more involved in it and really put his emphasis on extreme conditions with muscle as well. Okay, so you can imagine if you have a low weight to lift, not something too heavy, you can move it pretty quick, right? But the heavier it is, you're not going to be able to move it so fast. So the velocity of movement is going to change depending on that weight. That's all that really was. So let's go through a little scenario with how muscle contracts. And we're going to kind of rapidly go through this, and then we're going to recap on it, okay? So you're looking at tension, and you're looking at what happens to this muscle. You add ATP, and you don't really get any muscle tension. Right? And you can do this. I don't know if you ever did this in high school. Did your teachers ever order rabbit muscle and you put it in? in microscope and you watch it. No, deprived. All right. So they can, you can order rabbit muscle that's been permeabilized. It's actually been glycerated in glycerol, and so it doesn't have the membrane. And you look at it in the microscope, and you know, just a regular dissecting scope, and you put ATP on, it doesn't do anything. So this same experiment is done in high schools, right? And we used to order it here. We did some in 350 at one time when it was really fun to just do labs and not do any writing. That was really fun. And so we had muscle there, and you could put ATP on, nothing would happen. But then you take ATP and calcium together, and all of a sudden you'd see it short. It was so cool. It was like, this is when you really say, whoa, ow, ooh, that's so neat, right? And that's exactly what would happen. But we couldn't really remove the calcium so well, but you could at least see it contract. So the idea is it's not just ATP, it's ATP in calcium. Why the calcium? Remember? What did the calcium have a key? That's right. Binds to the troponin, causes the conformation chain, explodes the active site so the myosin can bind. And then once it does bind, how to get that off is that you have to hide the active site. Otherwise, it stays contracted. The way to hide the active site is take calcium away, allow that that active site to be hidden again by the troponin. And now when the myosin comes back and it's trying to find more active sites, it can't bind because it's hidden. So that's really neat. And it's a calcium-dependent process. Right, so calcium concentration dependent, and so it all relates with conformational change. So now when we talk about troponins, there's a three complex, troponin C, I, and T. There's some little debate about it all, but generally, a troponin C, calcium binding. How to remember that? C for calcium, right? So it's relatively straightforward. If you're taking standardized exams, it's still on some standardized exams, calcium binds to troponin C, of that complex causes a conformational change. Remember the tail of the troponin, T for tail, that could help you. T for tail is in this place in down here, and that then goes between the tropomyosin grooves and helps hold this together, right? And then the tropomyosin's wound inside of the actin, right? And then you think troponin I, well, just think of intermediate, right? So you got calcium binding, you got a tail, and what's in between? An intermediate. Okay, so that way maybe you can remember these and not forget what they do. So here's the idea. Calcium binds to troponin C, causes a conformational change, expose the active site, and now myosin can bind to this active site. I mean, they should have something like red down here or something for myosin. So don't get confused. People in the past have gotten confused with this figure that's in textbooks. This is not the myosin. The troponin complex up there is not the myosin head, right? It's moving out of the way to expose the active site. Okay, and we just talked about calcium. So it needs calcium, and then if you take calcium away, well, that doesn't do anything. The myosin heads are still bound. How do you get the myosin heads off? That takes ATP. So for the heads to come off, then you need ATP. And so then you hydrolyze ATP, and now you can remove the... you can take the myosin head off, and it's going to ratchet back. But it can't rebind if there's no active site. And there's no active site because calcium is absent. So if this is a little bit fast or confusing, definitely take some time and think about this in a conformational aspect, okay? Because this is important to understand in that part. Okay, and we look at muscle contraction. We go through the whole thing. So what do you want to do? You want to be walking down the street and thinking in your head, how do I get muscles to contract? And how does this work? So you know about nerves already, right? Nerve, action potential down, presynaptic nerve terminal, open up voltage gated calcium channel, calcium comes in, but it has to be taken away, right? And then vesicles to use, release neurotransmitter, the thing that's your neuromuscular junction, acetylcholine. Acetylcholine goes across the synaptic cleft, binds to receptors. All right, but then how does that relate to muscle contraction? So let's go through some of that aspect. But when you get that action potential in the muscle fiber, the muscle fiber itself can make an action potential. Your skeletal muscle, frog muscle. Not all muscles. Some of the crayfish muscle is graded. Some of the insect muscles are graded. They don't make action potentials. But in a mammalian system, you get an action potential. And we'll come back to that in a little bit. And then, so you're measuring the action potential in the muscle fiber, and then you get tension development. There's this delay. What causes this delay, and what's all that about? Okay, so let's go through some of this muscle contraction. They didn't know that if you move along the muscle fiber and you kind of depolarize in different regions along the muscle fiber, especially with some calcium there, or you could use electrical stimulation, that you will find a spot where it will contract locally, not the whole muscle fiber, just locally. So you can look at the membrane potential, and as it depolarizes in that region, then you get more muscle tension. So something to do with depolarization of that muscle fiber. And it's usually around the Z disc where that is most sensitive, and we'll go into why that happens. So if you look down the Z disc, they usually line up with the plasma membrane that enfolds right by the Z disc. And these are called T-tubules. So the T-tubule is nothing different than the plasma membrane that's just enfolding inside deeper in the muscle. The thicker the muscle, the deeper those T-tubules go. So in some invertebrates, like little Drosophila maggots, for example, the larvae, their muscles are so thin, they don't even have T-tubules. So that's kind of interesting. So the thicker the muscle, the deeper the T-tubules, to get down into the meat of it all. What happens down in that T-tubule? What happens? Why do you have to have depolarization in the T-tubule? So that's related to this next part. Next to the T-tubule, inside the muscle fiber, is the structure called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. You might have heard of it in other cells, the ER. It's basically the ER. But in muscle fiber, we call it sarcoplasmic reticulum. It's basically the endoplasmic reticulum. Okay? And that is inside the cell, inside the muscle fiber. So what's going on with this sarcoplasmic reticulum next to the Z-disc and next to those T-tubules that invaginate inside? Let's just jump ahead. So the idea is depolarization comes down the T-tubule. It actually changes this protein conformation called the dihydropyridine receptor. Why do they name it that way? Just the confusion. No. It's this protein which they know this drug binds to this receptor. Okay? So they just named it this, dihydropyridine receptor. Okay, what's interesting is it is a protein that changes its conformation with electrical depolarization. So now here comes this electrical gradient down the muscle fiber, an action potential comes down the muscle fiber, down the T-tubule, causes the dihydropyridine receptor, this protein, to change its conformation. And that conformational change can then pull on a protein inside the cell. And that protein that's inside the cell is this ranidine receptor, a ranidine protein. The ranidine protein is bound to the ER. So think of it like the bathtub plug in a bathtub. If you pull the bathtub plug out, what's going to come out? All the water. Well, think of the water as calcium. The sarcoplasmic reticulum is packed full of calcium. So the dihydropyridine receptor changes its conformation, pulls the plug out of the bathtub inside the cell, and calcium's dumping out. Well, what's that calcium going to do? Bind to troponin C, right? And then cause the conformational change and get muscle contraction. Well, what happens to the calcium inside the muscle fiber in the cytoplasm? It has to be taken back up. And it's taken back up very fast by these pumps. And you see them all over here, calcium pumps. These are called these pumps, sarcoplasmic reticulum ATP-dependent pumps. So this CIRCA pump. Basically, it pumps calcium back in very fast. So think about how fast can you contract your muscle and relax it? How fast can you contract and relax it? That's going to be dependent on how fast the calcium can come back down, right? So you see in some muscles, very fast contraction. If you look at them and you stain them up, you found a tremendous amount of these calcium pumps in the ER, in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Two really good examples we'll bring up here in a little bit is quite interesting about these muscles. So let's back up a little bit. And people have done studies to know that calcium inside of the muscle fiber relates to the muscle contraction. You can put calcium indicators, just like what we talked about with the nerve, the squid axon. As calcium rises inside of here, or if you stimulate it and down the T-tubule, you will see the calcium come out to the cytoplasm. And then you see the muscle tension. So lots of studies have been done relating the muscle contraction with calcium, just like with synaptic transmission or vesicle fusion with calcium. Okay, so here it is, action potential, and then you get the calcium domain rises inside the cell, and then you get the force of muscle contraction. So it's all related in this series. All right, and there's the T-tubules coming down, there's your contractile elements, and then you see the T-tubule right here, and you see the proteins. So here's the dihydropyridine receptors, and then you think about these ranidine receptors right there. So they pull that plug out, and the calcium's going to dump out onto the troponin C, and you're going to get muscle contraction. Now, some textbooks will actually show that that the dihydropyridine receptors, these ones on the T-tubule, people get these confused on tests. You got to get the order right. You're going to miss some points. They'll get confused with ranitidine and dihydropyridine. So dihydropyridine first, and then ranitidine. How to remember that? Alphabetical order. Okay? Alphabetical order. That's the way to remember that. So some textbooks will actually show the dihydropyridine receptor as a calcium channel, and that's causing calcium to load in. People have now done studies and realized that that's more of experimental conditions and only under high depolarization. But under physiological conditions, that has changed now. So the idea is that the dihydropyridine receptor is really just a conformational change. It can be a calcium channel, but it's not under physiological conditions. We had a really good seminar from somebody from Cincinnati about a year ago here to talk about this too. It was really quite neat. Okay, so now we've gotten through all this, plug and calcium and contraction. So remember when we talked about that passive tension? Titan is thought to be the main key now, so the textbooks haven't really caught up with that, but they still consider like the contractile component and then this elastic component that's in parallel. We'll think of that as now Titan, are also the plasma membrane, and that whole dystrophin complex, right? That's not mentioned in the textbooks so much, unless you got like a newer one. And this parallel elastic component, think of that as the dystrophin and everything we've talked about, Titan, and the basal membrane, okay? Just to kind of keep it in sync. Okay, so you can imagine if you contract your muscle, you can contract it, but then if you try to lift something really heavy, it's going to have repetitive firing, right? And it's not going to relax in between. So that's what's referred to as this tetany. So repetitive contraction, really fast rate, it's not relaxing in between. High frequency of action potentials in the muscle fiber. Also, the nerve has to be activated. But you can do this experimentally just by stimulating the muscle fiber too, versus a lower frequency where it can relax in between. But to keep this tetany going, calcium has to stay loaded inside of the cell, right, to keep that force going and not where it comes back down. And then think about the energy demand. Those pumps to pump calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum take ATP, right? The myosin head to come off takes ATP. So what do you expect in muscles that are working really hard? A lot of mitochondria. And that's what you get, a lot of mitochondria in muscles that work really well. The byproduct, whoa, what do we get here? CO2. What's the other byproduct? Water, right? So you're making water inside your muscle. That has to get out of there, otherwise it's going to swell up. And then the CO2 can diffuse right across the bilipid membranes, but all this needs oxygen, too, to keep those mitochondria going. So think inside the muscle fiber, you could write in your notes, think of myoglobin that's inside the muscle fiber, pulling oxygen in, pulling it off the hemoglobin. And when we talk about hemoglobin in the respiratory chapter, we'll talk more about some of those processes. But that will help you. So remember we talked about some different muscle fiber types. We talked about red and white. But then let's look at fast muscle fibers are also referred to as, which I didn't tell you before, twitch muscle fibers. So fast, twitch, white. What was the other idea? White, fast. Now I'm drawing a blank. You help me out. White muscle fibers, fast muscle fibers. What was the other word? I forget it. Phasic. Yes, thank you. Okay. Phasic. Yes, phasic. It's right there. Right. All right, so phasic muscle fibers. You can break these down into different groups. You can break them down into slow oxidative, and then think about the other extreme, fast glycolytic. And then there's something in between. Actually, these muscle fiber types can be broken down into like five general classifications. But for our purposes, let's think about these three general types. Slow oxidative, and fast glycolytic. What does that mean? Glycolytic means glycolysis, right? Oxidative means mitochondria. So let's look at the two extremes. Let's think of glycolytic. Well, if it's undergoing glycolysis, do we expect a lot of mitochondria in there? No. So if you look at the mitochondria for glycolytic, it's low. For oxidative, it's high. So if you have to write an open response question, what's the differences of fast muscle for glycolytic and oxidative, you could recreate some of these main points. The other aspect is the myosin ATPase activity. ATPase activity. So how fast it can go back and forth. Well, fast glycolytic is a really fast muscle fiber. So that's like really super fast, right? So that's going fast. So the myosin ATPase activity is really high over here. All right? And then you think about, what else? Enzymes for anaerobic glycolysis. Glycolysis, right? So if we're just for the glycolysis, if it's only going to use that process, that's really high. So it has a lot of enzymes for glycolysis. And then I think we have, and you can see some nice staining patterns. You can stain up these muscle fibers in different ways. You can stain up for mitochondria. You can stain up for the enzymes for glycolysis. You can stain it in different ways, and you can come up with these different staining patterns depending on how you're staining. So you don't have to memorize, you know, that black is this or white is that. This all depends on what you stain for. But if you were staining for mitochondria, then which muscle fiber type would stain up the most? The glycolytic, right? Because they have more mitochondria. No, sorry, just the other way around. The oxidative. Sorry, I got that confused. Anybody on echo? That's confusion. Okay, so more mitochondria for the oxidative ones compared to the glycolytic. If you stained up for the glycolytic enzymes, that's where I was going, then you're going to see more staining in this very fast muscle fibers. If you want to write in your notes something here, you could say slow muscle or red muscle and put that on this side over here because it is accentuated over on this side. Okay? So red muscle would be more of this on this side over here. Because it has more mitochondria and it doesn't fatigue, right? It's being used all the time, pretty much. So really slow muscle. Now you can kind of divide that up and think about just all muscle as general, like red, white muscle, or you can just kind of take this in. As I mentioned, there's like five different muscle fiber types. You can get an extreme type of slow muscle, so you could actually put super slow muscle over here. All right, that might help you. But I don't want to go through all the different fiber types. If you look at different animals, then you can really see some interesting aspects. Like I mentioned, you know, animals kind of work in this range up here, most of the animals, amphibians. We do have some muscles that work in the far left-hand side, like the barnacle muscle that we were talking about. But you don't work way out here to overstretch muscle that would be damaged. So here's something really interesting. Looking at the different types of muscle fiber types and classifying them with the animal behavior, which is the next chapter. So they've come up with some really neat names for some of these muscles that they've looked at. There's the red muscle that we just mentioned, slow muscle. White muscle, the fast muscle, right? And you look at the calcium domain inside of the muscle fiber, all right? So red muscle, the calcium comes up and it goes down really slowly. White muscle or phasic muscle, it goes up, but it comes down really quick, so it can contract again, right? So you can keep jumping and shooting baskets. But there's this odd muscle called the sonic muscle. The calcium comes up and goes down really quickly. This comes from the boatfish, which makes this weird sound, you know, like a little humming sound. And they looked at how can it contract and relax a muscle so fast? And so they call this the sonic muscle. And the sonic muscle contracts, relax. And the way they can do that is because they can have that calcium rise, but drops really fast. And how does it do that? The pumps in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It can pump that calcium up so fast that it doesn't stay very high, so it can contract again. So it's really quite interesting related with calcium. So these are the ideas. And then the twitch relates with the calcium domains. So you can kind of get the idea of these muscle fibers. Now, so the sonic muscle, very quickly, up, down, up, down, up, down, out, down, and that means the muscle can relax in between. So it relates with that calcium uptake. So you can imagine a lot of mitochondria around to keep that thing going. Then they found out this other muscle, which is really cool, and we'll end on this, the shaker muscle. This is, and we have rattlesnakes in Kentucky, right? But, you know, you don't see them around all the time. My hometown, look it up, CNN has a hit on that, Sweetwater, Texas, the world's largest rattlesnake roundup in the world. People come from all over to go to the rattlesnake roundup. What did we do in high school? We used to make extra money by collecting rattlesnakes and selling at the rattlesnake roundup. Go down to the convention center and have a rodeo that day and all this kind of stuff. And they select pageant queens, the rattlesnake queen, and all this. It's really cool. It's a big event. So it was really wild because when I was in high school, we always participate and we collect rattlesnakes because I grew up in a farm area, ranch area. And we'd collect rattlesnakes, put them in 50-gallon drums, save them, throw in mice. I know it's horrible. And then save them for the rattlesnake roundup. Because when you take them to the rattlesnake roundup, they buy them off you based on weight. And if you had the biggest rattlesnake, you'd really make more money. So you keep giving them mice all the time. But then I got to college, took a biology class, and the biology honor group was actually going down during the rattlesnake roundup, which is the second weekend in March, I believe. So it's coming up in case you want to take a field trip to Sweetwater, Texas. And they were going down to do what? Protest the rattlesnake roundup method. Oh my God. Why are we protesting the rattlesnake roundup? And I didn't know it at the time, because nobody tells you anything, is that there's an endemic turtle that's to that area, the Sweetwater area. And how do you collect rattlesnakes? You go around in early in the morning, before the sun rises, because by 9 o'clock it could be already 90 degrees or 100 or something in the summer. And you spray diesel into the holes, or kerosene, with a sprayer. And then you come back around. The snakes can't handle that. They will come out. But it's still cold, right? And they're heterotherms. I didn't know all that when I was in high school, because we didn't learn anything in high school. But then you come out, and the rattlesnakes are out. And you could actually grab them with your hand, or with tongs if you're, you know, skittish, right? And put them in a bag and then throw them in the 50-gallon drum. But the problem was, there's this turtle that's endemic to that area, and they can't escape from that diesel or that kerosene, so they could die inside of the places, and so their populations were grown. Then I realized, but I wasn't going to go with them to protest, because I know what would happen. You'd be dragged behind a pickup truck or something. And that was that part. But it's kind of interesting, when you hear the rattlesnake, you can actually tell, is it able to strike at you or not, by just listening to the rattle. If it's like a pathetic rattle, nah, you might risk it. But if you hear it, you don't risk it. You back away, right? And you use your palms. And it relates to this muscle. So this muscle is super fast in contraction and relaxation. I just wanted to show you that it's temperature dependent too. And think about 1.4 milliseconds, calcium can go back down. That is amazing fast. Okay, we will finish up with muscle. There's only a few little things to hit on Tuesday. And then we're into behavior. We'll probably finish most of the behavior. The PowerPoints are up online on Canvas as well as in your web page. Try to work on your assignment if you got time.